Hey, what's up? Just a couple things here at the top here. My guest today is going to use a word that might make some of you uncomfortable. He's going to drop a couple N-bombs in the interview. I don't even think of them as N-bombs when he says them. He's black, and he says the N-word sometimes when he's talking in casual conversation because he can do that, and it's fine. And yeah, it's like it's not – I feel like the one with the hard R is the N-bomb one, and then what he says is just like a word that Stevie says sometimes. So yeah, there's that. And the other thing is we are going to be talking about violence perpetrated by police toward – people of color and marginalized communities quite a bit on this episode. You saw the title of the episode. You saw what it was about. Just wanted to make sure that I say that up at the top. Be advised. Here we go. Several days ago, body cam footage surfaced of an altercation between police officers in Rochester, New York, and a local family there. A 9-year-old girl, who appeared to be having a domestic dispute with her mother, ran from the scene and from the attending officer who arrived first. The video plays out in all too familiar detail. The officer berates and pesters the clearly and understandably upset 9-year-old and insists that the girl follow his commands, getting more and more aggravated every time she refuses. It's nothing we haven't seen before in these videos. Poorly trained, underpaid officers coming in hot to an already tense situation and not being able to maintain their composure when their commands aren't heeded with the utmost urgency and respect. The difference in this instance is that the person the officer was trying to command control of was a literal child. At one point, the officer even says, "You're acting like a child," to which the girl appropriately responds, "I am a child." By now, I'm sure you know the climax of this awful and hauntingly ordinary video. The police successfully wrestled the girl into handcuffs and then proceeded to spray her in the face point blank with pepper spray once they had her detained in the back of a cruiser. If this is the first you're hearing of this instance, then yes, you just heard me correctly. Several adult police officers wrestled a 9-year-old girl into handcuffs and then pepper sprayed her. I don't need to tell you the race of the girl in question. You knew it the moment you first heard of this story. Because this isn't even close to the first time police officers have been unnecessarily harsh with a minor who happens to be a person of color. It's just the latest. There are so many other, more reasonable, less violent ways this altercation could have unfolded. Apologists will, of course, point to the fact that the officer clearly tried communicating with the girl and he repeated his instructions multiple times. But to anyone who wants to make that kind of gross justification for such clearly unacceptable behavior, I would just offer this. Is there any chance that had the officer arrived on the scene and found a crying, cold, scared, clearly emotionally distressed, white 9-year-old girl, he would have proceeded to shout instructions at her and threaten her with physical violence if she did not comply before finally proceeding to inflict said violence? The answer to that question is frustratingly, maddeningly obvious. Again, this is just the latest video in a disgustingly large library of similar videos. It's important to mention that it's not only bad because she was 9, it's also bad when this kind of thing happens to black and brown adults. The fact that the girl was 9 just makes this case an especially clear example of the inherent issues with America's police. Many people, regardless of political persuasion, can watch a video like the one I just described and experience a visceral, compassionate response that informs them that what they are watching is definitely not okay and that something should be done. The problems tend to occur when we start trying to talk about what exactly should be done. My good pal Stevie and I met in Brooklyn in around 2016. We hung out pretty much every night during my near 3-year stint in Bushwick. For all intents and purposes, we were, and still are, dem boys. He's a massively intelligent person, and he knows a ton more on this subject than I do. He's going to break down the history of the police and its inherent white supremacist roots, talk about why defunding and abolishing the police isn't nearly as scary as you were told to believe it is, and examine what possible routes forward may be available to us if we choose to finally confront this issue in a meaningful, substantive way. From a Blankenfort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my good friend Stevie McFly about the police. Hey, so let's talk about this stuff a little bit. I first texted you earlier this year about this when we were doing lots of protests, and when, you know, George Floyd and Breonna Taylor just happened, and it was like the those first few weeks of like lots of heat. Like it was the news story that almost eclipsed the pandemic and the I think it did eclipse it for a couple weeks, for a few weeks, and then, but.
I mean, kind of.
Yeah.
Especially because at that time we were in a greater sense than we are now being taken care of. I mean, obviously things were still not being controlled in like a really meaningful sense.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it's still like, I think by the time the protests were really, really going, most states had kind of gotten their shit together with unemployment as far as getting it out in people's hands, and things like that. So it was a lot less, it felt less completely unmanageable and dire, because bills were getting paid.
Yeah.
At least.
Well, people had free time too, to get involved. Like people had free time to be like, I can like give some time to this. I can give some time and some energy and some attention to this, you know?
Right. Yeah. And, I wish the energy had been able to keep moving forward.
Yeah, me too.
I think a lot of it was just like media coverage and then into the election.
The media
kept covering it as like, basically once they had exhausted whatever clicks they could get out of, the whole Trump sending unmarked troops into black bag people.
Yeah.
Story. Like, I guess once people, somehow got bored of that story.
Yeah.
They just sort of gave up on, on really covering the protests, and we're just kind of like talking about them like they were over, and there was still shit happening. Like you'd still see on, you know, social media, the kind of things that were still going on, but they kind of just, they were like, well, you know, Biden has promised to have a meeting about setting up a conference to think about a task force to talk about, maybe giving sensitivity training seminars, an hour and a half a year to
like,
police.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the whole rhetoric around, like from the mainstream media and, you know, gullible, credulous dipshits about, defund the police fails to recognize that defund the police is itself a compromise. Abolish police is the real thing. And I think that as a slogan would occupy maybe the space that they're incorrectly stating that defund the police does.
So in terms of I had this in my questions that I was going to ask you. I was going to say, do you support defund the police or abolish the police, and why or why not? Like, cause I feel like these are terms that are so tough for people to wrap their brains around, and like I know a lot of people personally who, when they hear it, it just inspires like a knee-jerk response of fear and like, we can't do that. No, no, that's insane. Like, you can't just get rid of police, of a police force. Like, let's go into that a little bit. Like, explain to me, like, what specifically is meant in your mind by abolish or defund?
Well, let's start with defund, right? Because defund is the more mainstream position of the two.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that part of the reason that people don't understand it is because the both mainstream parties and all sides of mainstream media, you know, whether it be CNN, MSNBC, Fox, New York Times, like all of the left, right, not left, liberal-ish, like the center right to far right spectrum of mainstream American discourse, those publications have made it their job and made it their duty to discredit the idea of doing anything other than coddling police and increasing police budgets. So, you know, when people say that, you know, a municipality's budget is defunding the education system, I think most people can understand that doesn't mean they are taking all money away from schools and shutting down every public school in that area. The word defund is not inherently confusing. It's only confusing when the people who are supposed to know better and explain to you what the things are that you need to know are saying it's confusing and they want to take away all the money. Like when they just lie to you
right,
and say that it means something it doesn't, then if you don't know better or if you're not thinking critically, and if you are, if you're used to accepting what they tell you at not necessarily entirely face value, but something, you know, approaching face value, then you also will accept the confusion that they are trying to sow. But the word defund is not in general that confusing. It's a commonly used word when we're talking about, you know, political issues and budgets and that sort of thing. So the there's a lot of different perspectives on defunding the police, but the general principle, kind of the guiding principle across the board, is police budgets are too high.
Yeah.
The police are given too much power, and the militarized style of policing is detrimental to the function of society.
Yeah.
We've essentially, you know, I mean, the police have so much power that de Blasio, who, you know, he keeps like giving the NYPD a kiss on the cheek and a little chocolate mint on their pillow, tucking them in, reading them a bedtime story. And they act like he is literally like showing up to their jobs every day and slapping them in the face one by one. But when really like they put his daughter's home address, including apartment number, on Twitter. The police union's official Twitter account put his daughter's picture, name, home address, apartment number on Twitter because they saw her at a protest. And the next day, he went on TV. He did his little press conference. He was like, "No, I don't think that was appropriate, but, you know, I'm not going to do anything to the police. We respect our boys in blue." It's like, you fucking cuck. I hate the word cuck, but like... like, our politicians have made me want to use it because they are just fucking just letting themselves be just screwed repeatedly by the police and by the Republican Party and by, you know.
Remember when that guy, I think it was he the president of the New York NYPD Police Union, the guy that gave that speech where he was like, "This badge means something. And I'm not
crying under the bridge." Yeah,
he was crying, and he was like, "I'm not gonna apologize for being a cop."
Everybody's being mean to me. Yeah. Everybody's being mean to me just because I drive in from Suffolk County to beat the shit out of the niggas. Come on, fuck you, dog. Like, just because I love beating black people up for no reason.
You guys want to just be mean.
Everybody else, hey, I live in Suffolk County in a McMansion. My wife makes gravy every Sunday, and I beat the shit out of niggas every day. Fuck you, dude. The fuck on.
Yeah, yeah.
Like he makes a six-figure income and, you know, has the power to murder without consequence. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, yeah. It's, you know, it's like, you're not, pardon me, you're not marginalized or victimized because people are asking for a little accountability and they're asking for a little bit more of just like, hey, can you just be a little bit more ethical and a little bit moral with this like responsibility that we've like, give this massive responsibility that we've given you and this power, this unchecked power that we've given you to just murder at will and we will not question it. And it's like, hey, maybe the very, very, very least we can ask for is that you guys will just be like, a little bit more discerning with how you use that power to murder at will. Like, right. Maybe right. That's just the very least we can ask for. Or is that too much?
They're just the biggest, wettest babies aside from the one in the White House for the next week or so.
Yeah, so okay. So that's – so defund. Yeah, defund is this word where it's almost deliberately been misused in the media and in political campaigns against it, or just – or I guess shrouded with a deliberate misinformation campaign of like defund means no more money going to police departments, period. Like that, there goes all their money. No one can get paid. And like that's right. Obviously
like we're
just
– we're going to force them at gunpoint to be police, but we're not going to give them any money. Like that's like this like cartoonish delusion. That yeah. is being fed to people.
Yeah, and it's I thought that you talked earlier about kind of the media coverage of the protests and how like there was coverage about the paramilitary police blackbagging people in the Pacific Northwest, and there was lots of coverage for a couple weeks about riots and looting and things like that. That to me showed me something really interesting. The right in America, the extreme right and just the right in general, loves to talk about this narrative about how the mainstream media, or they type it MSM online, like they all talk about mm-hmm. this. The mainstream media has this massive bias against us. They hate us. They never say nice things about us. The mainstream media lies about us. And what the coverage of the Black Lives Matter protest showed me, and should show a lot of people if they're thinking critically, is that mainstream media doesn't have a political bias. They have a capitalistic bias. They're like, whatever's going to get clicks, whatever's going to get eyeballs watching our show. And if that's people rioting and looting, if that's like whatever's going to just have your attention, like we don't care whose politics we're promoting or what causes we're backing.
Right. As long as it supports capital to a sufficient degree, like, and yeah. that's why we had things like, during the 2016 primaries, there was a time when CNN had, you know, their cameras focused on the empty podium that Trump was about to speak on for an hour and a half, literally. Bernie was giving a speech at the same time, and they didn't show it so they could show an empty podium and be like, I wonder what he's going to say. We knew what he was going to say. He was going to go up to people. I'm having this tremendous rally. I'm having this tremendous rally. It's so big. Look at how many people there are. And I'm going to be a great president. And I'm going to jail all of the Mexicans and the Muslims and people. I'm going to do it for you. I'm doing it for you and you, my Americans. I love Americans. I love Americans. I love America. I've lived in this country my whole life, and I've been alive for a while, people, but not that long. And I've been, you know, and there are people that are older than me, and there are people that are younger than me, and they all hate Mexicans. Like, he's just going to rant and ramble.
He's just gonna say a bunch of bullshit. You've been working on that. You've been working on that impression. You've been tuning that up.
It's gotten better over time. Yeah, just in time for it. Just in time for it to not matter anymore.
Yeah.
I hope. Who knows, right? Like, we got people in Congress trying to help the chuds and the hogs overthrow the government. So.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
If Lauren Boebert's allowed to have her gun. On inauguration day, like, who's to fucking say what happens, man?
We love you. You're very special. We love you. It's so wrong. It's so wrong what they did. They stole it, but you've got to go home. Just like, what? Like,
yeah. Like,
Bro, you just told the terrorists that attacked the Capitol building that we love you and they're very special?
Right. It's like, he might as well have winked.
Yeah, yeah. We want no violence. Wink, wink. No violence. It really sounds like, if a mob boss like had a tape recorder at a meeting with like, you know, his henchmen, and he was like, listen, somebody cut off my supply of a shipment that was coming in, and I obviously don't want anything violent to happen to whoever did that, but you all should take care of that however you see fit. I'm of course saying no violence. No one should kill anyone about this, but someone should deal with it.
I want you guys to go talk to him. No violence. I'm definitely not saying anything. I'm not encouraging any violence. I just want words. You go have your words with them. You go down to the docks, all right? You have your words with them, and then you come back here and you let me know when you have spoken these words, these very strong and forceful words to them. When you have this conversation, you return here. But go home. Don't do any violence, all right? No violence here. Like, but the thing is that mob bosses are not even that stupid. Like, I feel like outside of movies, most of them have at least enough finesse to be more subtle. Maybe not. I don't know. But, like, at least at this point, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, we digress. What were you going to say? Sorry.
Like, the ones that want to, you know, survive because they've been... You know, the mob's been, at least the Italian mob's been decimated.
Oh, yeah.
And they're still functional.
Yeah.
They're not, there's not car bombs in Brooklyn every weekend, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. So defund, and that's a little bit about defund, where it's like, it's really, really at the core, the idea is their budget is too big. A lot of people feel this way about just the American defense budget, that it's like our defense budget just dwarfs the next, you know, 20 closest countries. Like we spend more on our military and on our defense than any country by far. And people feel this way about our police force too, that like the militarization of the police and their overinflated budget is a problem, and their unchecked power.
The NYPD, I think our police budget, you know, is like over half of the total budget.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So
we
that's
spend billions of dollars. Like, the NYPD would be one of the largest, like if New York seceded from the United States for whatever reason, the NYPD would be still one of the largest military forces in the world.
Yeah, which is crazy.
Yeah.
It's wild. So that's defund. That's a little, I mean, abridged version of defund. Let's talk a little bit about abolish. And you talked about how defunding is a compromise, and what it actually should be and is abolish. And that's your stance?
Yeah. Now, when I say abolish police, and there's different views on this, right?
Yeah.
I personally think that there would have to be some kind of function, because we're not, you know, we've not evolved into like an anarcho-communist like utopia of some kind. You know, we are still the people that we are. We've been raised in the society we have, and we have to work within the framework that we have to an extent, right? Like, we have to understand the people that we are, or that our society is comprised of, and kind of the way that that plays out typically. So essentially with abolishing the police, the purpose is to replace most of their functions with other things that could better serve those functions. Like for example, the most commonly cited thing is replacing, you know, responses to mental health situations with well-trained social workers and things like that. There's always, not always, but for a long time going forward, there still would have to be some sort of group of people to mediate disputes, to intercede in violent situations.
Of course.
You know, but I don't think that what is or has ever been thought of as the police in the United States is the appropriate form that that should take.
Yeah, we see this work in other countries too. Like we see that in the UK, for example, they have armed task forces that respond to, we've got a gunman or something, or we've got like a situation that requires our armed task force. But like, if a police officer is just making a traffic stop and giving you a speeding ticket, why does he have to have a gun? Like, why does my life have to be in danger in this situation where he might be like, I don't know, if you move too quick, I might just shoot you seven right. times. And
right, because they're most like jumpy, scared people.
Yeah,
like they just assume that everybody who is black, especially, might murder them at any given moment. Mm-hmm. And that's not like a way to live life. I think whatever sort of mediation and violence intercession, hostage negotiation, like whatever sort of, and like crime investigation organization or set of organizations or whatever framework, we would develop in a sort of post-police world. First of all, I think that anybody who has been a cop should not be eligible to be in whatever the future framework would be.
Ooh, because fascinating.
They've been inculcated with this culture that is, I don't think that can be really trained out of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a culture of violence and mm-hmm. oppression. And, even if they were given a new set of standards to uphold and a new way to behave, I think that at least a lot of them, even ones who are well-intentioned, but like, get caught up in the bandwagon of the thin blue line.
Right.
Would still fall back into their old ways. I think that those old habits die hard, especially when you're an adult, especially when you've been working a job that, they do a lot of overtime and whatever, and a job where you feel like you were, even if it's unjustified, and it is, you feel like your life's in danger or whatever. I don't think they always feel like their lives are in danger. I think a lot of times that's bullshit, but like, say they do, just for the sake of it, I don't think that that's something that like is easily bred out just by, joining a new organization.
Right. And I
especially
tend
to, if the responsibilities overlap.
Yeah. I tend to agree.
Why
am I echoing right now? I'm getting, I tend to agree that, the vast majority of I think the average police officer in America's job is like nonviolent interactions with citizens over domestic disputes, mental health issues, traffic citations. Just breaking up a fight down at the whatever it is. Like I'd say the vast majority of things that they find themselves involved in are things where you don't actually need to fear for your life or have your hand on your pistol or anything like that. And I think that, you just said that where it's like they fear for their lives all the time, it seems like, but they probably don't need to. But yeah, I with this, there's a few interesting things about that, about like what this new crime response force would look like, or armed task force would look like. One thing that I think gets brought up a lot in these conversations is like the training for what we currently have always seems grossly insufficient. Like, it just does not seem like these people are highly trained enough to have such a intense responsibility,
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think that whatever set of organizations would replace, what we think of currently as police, would definitely need more and more specialized training than the police have. Absolutely. But essentially one of the main things that it comes down to is, aside from the culture of police, which, it's the descendant of a long history, American policing largely descends from slave patrols. It has been a white supremacist institution from the outset. And it's been largely used to uphold and maintain white supremacy and capitalism. But aside from you know, the culture that has just been built in by, you know, tradition and years, decades, centuries of, you know, X trained Y who trained, you know, like the Begat section of the Bible, but about cops.
Sure.
And cop culture. Aside from that, the thing is that the incentives of our justice system are fucked up, right?
Explain that.
So, for example, right, cops, they are judged and evaluated on the number of arrests they make,
yeah,
and the number of tickets they hand out. Even if there's no quotas, their performance will be compared against other officers based on, you know, arrests made, tickets handed out, cases closed, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So their incentive is to close a case, not to find the truth as best as possible. So you see this in a lot of, you know, if you ever watch true crime shit or like read about, you know, follow anything with the Innocence Project or things like that, cops often, they will, they may do like a bare minimum amount of investigating, but once they have a narrative in their head and they're kind of going on that, they will lie, they will hide evidence, they will fabricate evidence, they will, you know, do whatever they can to just close the case.
Yeah.
Even if they are fully aware that the person that they have been spending 2 months investigating is the wrong person.
Yeah, the Central Park Five. It's like they picked up these kids and they just were like, here's our story and we're gonna just hammer it until it fits. We're just gonna hammer these puzzle pieces together until they fit. And even kids that weren't there, that weren't even there that night. And we're, you know, just gonna hammer these. Yeah, it happens all the time.
Yeah. And the same goes for prosecutors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you see, especially when you see ads leading into elections for elected prosecutors, you see things like, you know, I have 100% or 99% or whatever conviction rate. And it's like, oh man, that says bad things. Because there is no way possible that 100% of the cases that the cops hand to you are that you have the right person. That's right. Just, that never happens outside of, that doesn't even happen on SVU.
Yeah.
You know, even when it's fictional cops, they don't get it right 100% of the time. There's absolutely no way that you're going to be handed correct, legitimate cases every single time. So when a prosecutor says that, what it tells me is that they are willing to bend the truth, hide things from the defense, and do whatever they can to nail whoever the cops hand them to the wall. The second the cops hand them a suspect and are like, this is our guy, we're going to file charge. You should file charges. And they file the charges, that they're like, this is our guy and we're going to fucking stick to it no matter what, no matter how much evidence is handed contrary, you know, we're just going to go and get that fucking conviction. And those people are the ones, because of how it's framed, who are regarded as the best prosecutors. So our system incentivizes just putting as many people behind bars as, you know, we can, as there are crimes, regardless of if we have caught the right person at all.
Yeah. I actually think I like this. I'm going to like, shift tactics for this whole conversation. I came into this conversation thinking we were going to talk more about like Black Lives Matter as an organization and everything like that. Obviously, tangentially, I think that that's still something that we're talking about, but I actually like staying focused on the police as a more, centralized topic. And I think I'm probably even just going to change the title of the episode to The Police, because I actually really like this. And I think there's more that I want to explore and I don't want to move away from it. So
you need Roxanne, you know?
Yeah. I think that there's so much because this is kind of the thing that I think keeps a lot of people away from, siding with Black Lives Matter. And like, they can see the videos and they can see the evidence and they can see like they can feel that like, yeah, that doesn't seem right to me. But then on the other side of it is this fear of like, but I don't know what to do without, like, we need cops, obviously. And so,
yes, well, there's also just like our so much of, American pop culture is built on propaganda.
That's I was just going to say that. You brought up SVU, and I was going to say I was going to go, how about all of the propaganda that we've been fed from the time we were born about police and police officers and detectives? Like, it is all about them being our superheroes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Even going back to like Westerns and things like that. Like, it's the sheriff who's stopping the bad guy. You play Cops and Robbers as a kid, you know, it's all. And then, all of the cop shows, you know, from the invention of television,
Well, they're portrayed as people in society with unimpeachable morals. They're the best kinds of people. Like, the best kinds of people choose to be cops, putting their lives on the line day in and day out. People who think of others before thinking of themselves. People whose, like, sole drive in life is to bring criminals to task and to make society a safer, more just place. These are the things that we are taught about police officers. And so when people talk to me about like the police and what they and the service that they provide for our country and for our communities, I'm like, you're not technically wrong that an organization needs to exist to handle crime and to interfere when things get bad. But you are definitely buying into this story you've been told that there's no such thing as cops who are just a person who needed a job, and now their job is guy with a gun who gets to kill people.
Right. There's also just like we a lot of people have this conception that just like, yeah, there's like some cops are bad people and then the rest are good, like they're generally good. No is the answer to that, because like, first of all, people talk about a few bad apples. The saying is a few bad apples will spoil the bunch.
Right. Right.
Or one bad apple will spoil the bunch is actually the saying.
Right.
Like, not even a few. So, you know, that's first of all, but also just the idea that, like, you know, they always tell stories about like, oh yeah, my uncle was a cop and he said, yeah, there were bad guys in the department, but none of us liked them. And it's like, but why didn't you get them fucking fired? Like, why did you defend them? Why did you stand by them when they got in trouble for killing somebody? You didn't say, oh man, that was that guy fucked up and killed somebody and I want him fucking gone. Or that guy says fucking racist stuff in the locker room, I want him fucking gone. Even the ones who claim to be good cops, they either say nothing or they end up like Adrian Schoolcraft and get fucking put in a mental institution, or like I forget the guy's name in Chicago, who was the two police officers, drove him off into like an abandoned area and shot him and left him for dead, because he was going to report on them to the Chicago PD. You know, these things, that's how fucking cops react to you breaking the thin blue line.
Well, and that's why people call them a gang. That's why people use these terms. Like, the reason they call Trumpism a cult is because it looks like a cult. It looks and smells and behaves like a cult. And the reason they call the cops a gang is because they look and behave like a gang. Like, it's blood in, blood out. Like, even if you disagree with something that your coworker is doing, like, cops don't rat on other cops, and like cops back each other. And like, there's this gang mentality of like, even if we disagree with one of our coworkers, we back each other because we're out there and it's us versus them. And there is this mentality of, rather than them out there to protect us, it's them out there like against us. Like, there is a warfare of them versus us.
Right. Like, they're supposed to rule over us. And if we step out of line, we are enemy combatants.
Yeah. And I can't, like, I mean, I, this is 100%
occupying force at least as much as the U.S. military does overseas.
Yeah. This is 100% speculation. But this guy, this Capitol Hill police officer that just committed suicide, like, when that happened, my first thought was, this dude probably has a Blue Lives Matter or like a thin blue line flag in his house. And he probably is a back the blue, thin blue line believer. Like, he's probably a member of this ideology, and it probably shattered his psyche and broke his heart to see his team turn on him and attack him violently. I don't think
that.
What do you think?
I mean, I guess it's a possibility. I don't know much about, I don't know if they've like released the identity of the officer who died by suicide, or like what his sort of whole deal was.
Right.
I know that the officer that was killed on scene was a Trump guy. So he probably, as he was being beaten to death, thought that.
Yeah.
But like the one who died by suicide, I don't know what his sort of deal was, but like, I think it's more likely that he was worried there'd be consequences for his actions.
Yeah, maybe, actually.
Because a lot of cops, you know, there's video of cops, you know, opening up the barricades to let them in. A lot of the physical altercations with the protesters and the cops, or the rioters and the cops, whatever you want to call them, you know, it looks like fucking slap boxing in homeroom in high school. Like, it's just play fighting. You know, yeah. Like, I have been actually at the Capitol, storming the Capitol, and been, this was many years ago, and been, I've seen what the Capitol Police can do in that situation. They were not doing the most that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't even doing, because the thing is, when we were doing it, they weren't even doing the most that they could do. And it was still just not even comparable at all.
I think it's also important to talk about, because this is one thing, is like capital sieges and protesting when you're dissatisfied with a political outcome and stuff like that. People have been talking about for the last week that this is something that has happened historically on both sides, and that's technically true. And I think it is important in the conversation of like Black Lives Matter and protesting and stuff like that to acknowledge that context really matters, though. Like, why you're doing what you're doing really matters. If you're doing what you're doing because you care that people were murdered and that their murderers continue to be let off the hook and with no repercussions, and that's why you're protesting, it seems like a compassionate, noble thing. But if you're attacking because you want to overthrow a fair democratic election because you're part of a cult and your cult leader told you that it was stolen, even though he told you it was stolen before it ever happened, like before it even happened, he was like, if I lose, they cheated.
Yeah, he said both times, like, if I lose, it's stolen.
Yeah, if I lose, they cheated. And but like,
right.
So like, I do think it's important really quick to just say context matters, because I feel like people are going to hear what you just said and be like, he just admitted that like they're just as bad. And it's like, no, of course, context matters. Context matters.
Right. Yeah. If you walk up to like a guy on the street who's, you know, at a fruit stand looking at an apple and you punch him in the face, that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
If you are, trying to stop a Nazi from hurting somebody, and you punch that Nazi in the face, well, that's a different situation. The literal action might be the same,
right?
But the context is different. And yes, we were doing an anti-war protest in 2007,
mm-hmm.
We ended up trying to storm the Capitol. Honestly, like, strategically, it was, at least as dumb.
Sure.
We didn't have a plan, you know. They had a plan. Unfortunately, their plan was murder. But, like, our plan was, I guess, just to go inside and just occupy it and just be like, hey, we're just going to sit here until you fucking do something.
Right.
But like, you know, but we didn't get that far, man. Like, we literally, so we're running up the lawn or up the, you know, through the National Mall at the lawn. And like, the cops, you know, put up a line to block us. And, you know, they were punching specifically the women and the shorter men. You know.
Yep.
They were not engaging. Even me, like, they didn't. And the cops directly in front of me were like my height or shorter. I'm an average height man, but like, you know, they were in better shape than me. Probably. I mean, I was in pretty good shape back then, but like, not like I have to work out every day. or whatever shit, you know? But like, yeah, they punched my friend Sarah in the chest. You know, we broke through that. They put up another line. We broke through that. Then they came out with the motorcycles. Then they were like, I got hit in the shin with a police motorcycle. We broke through that. And then we got to the steps and they had people lined up at the steps. And they pulled out their batons basically. And they were just like, nah, pretty much. They, you know, and we knew we weren't getting through like a wall of cops with batons. So, you know, yeah, we didn't get in. We didn't fucking get in. They didn't let us in. Right. They didn't, we had probably about as many people, maybe not quite as much. We had a lot of fucking people. The media downplayed it. You know, I found it funny when the Associated Press reported it as 50 anarchists. When you see this video and you can see that it's clearly like, at least a few hundred, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, when the police want to stop people from getting in the Capitol, they fucking do. I saw a picture from, you know, that same year, a different protest, where they were arresting veterans who were trying to get into the Capitol.
Yeah. Uniform. I mean, bottom line is they had more than enough information to have been more prepared on the 6th than they were. Like,
they were prepared. They opened the gates for these people. They fought with them for optics. Then they let them in. They took selfies with them. A few of the cops, specifically the black cops, you know, some of them, the ones that talk to like BuzzFeed and shit. Like, I don't know if you read that article, but like,
yeah,
you know, like there were some cops who were not on the side of at least the violent part of it. The attempts to murder Pence and Pelosi. But like, the rest of them were fucking on board. They were just ready to go.
Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this a little bit. So we talked about like the propaganda that we all grew up with. And this was something a narrative that I really realized this year. I'd never thought about it this year. And then I did an episode about this on my podcast, but like I was in comment sections fighting with people about the police and about whether or not we hold the police to a high enough standard. And all these people kept bringing up this movie to me. They were like, have you ever seen End of Watch? Have you ever watched End of Watch? They're like, that movie made me really understand what it's like to be a cop. And so finally I was like home alone one night and I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch this movie that everyone says is like so good. And I watched it and I was like livid through the roof because I was like, this is such a propaganda piece of shit. Like this movie is so full of shit. Yeah. And it's filmed like a found footage, like realistic handheld movie. It's made by David Ayer. I think David Ayer sucks. Anyway, it was a garbage movie, but yeah. So I think I realized like, oh my God, I've been fed propaganda about the U.S. military and about the presidency and about police officers and just about American nationalism my whole life. But what I want to talk about a little bit more is, and you talked about this earlier, is the way that from its inception, the current structure of the United States police force as an entire force is rooted in white supremacy and support of capitalism. Let's explain that a little bit, because I don't think enough people understand why people say that and what that actually means and like where that comes from.
Right. So, I mean, law enforcement through most of history has been handled by, you know, either some branch of the military of whatever nation state or by some kind of local patrol. The modern idea of policing descends from enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act. Mm-hmm. So essentially, you know, before the Civil War, there were slave states and there were free states. And enslaved people could escape. Like if they could escape to a free state, then they'd be free. So those who physically could do so did.
Uh-huh.
And then the southern states who had most of the power, thanks to how the, you know, the structure of our government was set up to appease them. They pushed for the Fugitive Slave Act, which essentially said that if you were enslaved in a slave state and you escaped to a free state, you must be returned to the slave state if you were caught. So the slave states created fugitive slave patrols that would go, you know, they'd get their warrants and they'd go, you know, search for the escaped slaves and they'd bring them back.
Yeah.
And that's the origin of those. And so those patrols sort of evolved into modern police forces. Now, after the Civil War, right, if you look at the 14th Amendment, it bans, or the
13th?
13th Amendment. 13th Amendment bans slavery except for as punishment of a crime.
Right.
So what they essentially did, and if you want to find out more about this, there's a documentary and a book. There's a PBS documentary based on a book called Slavery by Another Name. The documentary and the book will have information on that.
I like Ava DuVernay's movie 13th as well. It's really good.
That's also a good one. Yeah. But like there's more detail on specifically like the immediate postbellum, like reconstruction and failed reconstruction sort of period.
Yeah.
So basically, these plantations, you know, were slave owners who were not, you know, many of them were not punished. And a lot of the ones who were punished or had their land seized and given to, you know, their formerly enslaved, you know, people, essentially had, you know, then they had their land given back to them, thanks to the work of New York bankers.
Yeah.
Essentially, they needed labor, and they couldn't afford the volume of labor that they, you know, to which they were accustomed.
Right.
So, you know, they couldn't afford to pay black people a wage, so they had this little loophole, except as punishment for a crime. And so what they did was create laws that were vague or easy to fake or easy to enforce, like loitering or
yeah.
vagrancy or yeah. public intoxication, uh-huh. disturbing the peace, things that, you know, could be anything.
Resisting really arrest.
Right.
Yeah.
There's judgment calls by the arresting officer.
Uh-huh.
So what they would do is they would arrest black people for whatever, you know, invented or trumped up charge, and then they'd be sentenced to some long term, and then the prisons would lease prisoners out for slave labor to the plantations for a low cost. And what this did, it actually made you know, slavery in that period more brutal, because yeah. when the slaveholders were buying slaves, they were long-term investments.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you want, and it's I'm not saying this in any sort of obviously way to condone the horrific behavior of these people, but it's like they wanted their slaves to be able to continue to work so they didn't have to be replaced, and to be able to breed to make new slaves for free. So they didn't want, obviously, to beat anybody to death. But if they're renting them and there's no fine for beating them to death, they could work them or beat them to death and then call the prison up and or send somebody over to the prison, a messenger or whatever. I don't know how they communicated at this point. Telegraph, maybe. And be like, you know, hey, this week's slave died. Can you send another?
Yeah.
And they would do it. So they were even more brutal and horrific, you know, and they resented these people because, you know, slavery was over. Like they had lost a war. They had lost this country. They tried to found on the principle of slavery. of chattel slavery, specifically against Black people. And so they have, so now they have these people that they resent that they don't have any financial incentive to not beat or work to death. Right. And it was so bad that within 10 years of slavery, the stereotype of Black people had changed. During slavery, you know, the sort of phrenology explanation, which like if you've seen Django Unchained, that's the point of like the skull scene.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when he's talking about phrenology, basically.
Yep, yep.
You know, the whole idea was that Black people were inherently docile and servile.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that just the ridges in our skulls made it so that we were, you know, just great at being slaves and that we didn't want to be anything else. And that's what we were made for. And that we were loyal and trustworthy because just our skull ridges and our brains made it so that we are basically like fucking golden retrievers. Like we're just loyal and work hard and we'll just be working forever. Right.
Yep.
And, you know, it was to the point where you know, Dr. Samuel Cartwright, then considered one of the, you know, preeminent psychological minds, came up with a mental illness called drapetomania, which, you know, basically the concept was that if Black people wanted to run away from slavery, it was that they had this disease called drapetomania that infected their brains and made them want to run away. They have a disease.
I've never heard that before. That's crazy.
Yeah. And then within 10 years of the end of, you know, general legal slavery in the South, the stereotype became that Black people were inherently violent and ruthless and amoral and just wanted to
a total 180, just a complete 180 to suit the needs, to whatever the stereotype needs to be to suit the narrative. Mm-hmm. That's what it was.
Right. And the thing is that like, even people who were uninformed, apolitical, didn't have, like, relative to their time, relatively didn't have an opinion, you know, were convinced because the newspapers were publishing statistics. It's the same way that they do now, where it's like, oh, well, see here, you know, wow, since we freed the Blacks, like they're being arrested at these incredible rates. See the exponential rise in crime and all this.
Yeah, I love that. Like look at the numbers, look at the crime rates in these communities. It's like, yeah, isn't it shocking that the communities that you police more and where you make more arrests, there's higher numbers? It's kind of like when Republicans go on TV right now and they're like, so many people in America believe that this election was stolen. And it's like, yes, because you told them that. Like, it's like,
right. I would say it's more like when Trump talks about like the cases, we have so many cases because we're testing so many people. And that's why we have so many cases. If we tested less, we would have less cases. People, we're creating cases by testing people.
Right.
And it's like,
yeah. The numbers are up because you're arresting more people and you're arresting them for Trump for made up charges. Like, so yeah, my favorite thing that I've heard recently that I'd never heard this before. And I loved it because this is another one of those tired old arguments that you hear from people who are like the, quote, not racist people. Like, I'm not racist, but, and it's this argument where it's like, I'm not racist, but like Black people have been free and they haven't been slaves for like a long time now. Like what's with the fatherlessness in Black homes? And like, why can't they get their act together? This thing I heard recently that I loved was like, that's also seeped in generational trauma. Like Black people were bred when they were slaves and men learned to distance themselves from their offspring because they never really had a say over like what happened to the child. And then it carried on into after the 13th Amendment, men being pried away from their mm-hmm. families. So there had to be this sort of like emotional distancing from my family because I'm going to get yanked away from it anyway. And I need to sort of like shut down that part of my emotional response, like that instinctual response. And I'd never considered that before as a,
I think, I think that's a possibility, at least to an extent. I think more than that, it's the physical being yanked away. And there's an issue with how the statistics are presented, right? Because sure. We get this little bait and switch, right? Like, because there's a lot of, you know, talk about outcomes for children of single mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're presented with however many percentage of black children are born out of wedlock.
Yeah.
But born out of wedlock does not mean a single parent. You can have...
Right.
The parents could get married later. The parents could stay together but not get married. The parents right. could co-parent from nearby. The child could be raised by several family members and have, you know, a strong influence, you know, from family around.
Right.
You don't know. And also, you know, there's a large correlation between, class, economic class, and single motherhood.
Right. Yeah.
People who can afford to, people who are raised differently based on, you know, the culture of having more money in capitalism, which is a self-perpetuating culture.
Right.
And who can afford to get married. They can have the wedding they want. They can do all the things. If they're having issues with their relationship, they can get couples counseling and get marriage counseling. They have a greater access to solutions to the issues that other people may not have.
So it's multi-tiered is the idea, just like right. all and, this and stuff.
It's abuse of statistics, as are so many other things.
Yes. Because,
mm-hmm. you know, born out of wedlock is a meaningless statistic.
Yeah.
And single motherhood by itself is a meaningless statistic. If you're not considering, you know, like, how do you define a single mother? Is the father around? How much money does the family have? Who's involved? If you only look at the access of single motherhood, yes, a large portion of disproportionate to married couples, single mothers will have, you know, will be from lower income areas and have less disposable income and so on. But, you know, considered in concert with other things, you might have a at least somewhat different picture.
See,
but that doesn't sell the narrative that protects capital.
See, and I think exactly. This goes back to what we were talking about earlier with like the media bias. Are they biased conservative? Are they biased liberal? And like which networks have been bought off by which political interests? And the right is convinced that the entirety of journalists and media outlets in the entire world are against them, unless they're not. But I think it's so fascinating that pervasive narratives based around abused statistics like this have persisted for so long that like well-meaning mm-hmm. people, smart people, intelligent people have latched onto statistics around, single mother households or something like that, or born out of wedlock, and latched onto statistics that were designed to push a certain white supremacist and racist narrative, and they haven't actually been debunked till like very recently. We're starting to get more of these narratives into the mainstream, and we're starting to get more representation of like these actual explanations of what was going on in our like very clearly obviously racist past and how it's bled into the present. And we're very recently just starting to see these narratives, and the right is seeing that as evidence that liberals are taking over, where it's like, oh no, we're just like actually starting to like finally get some of these very old, persistent, pernicious narratives really looked at with some critical thinking, instead of just kind of going, right. I guess they just must be worse at caring for their children than white people are. I guess they just must be naturally just, you know,
inherently, you know. And it's like, you know, look, like, even if you ignore the fact that white people will be white no matter where they are, which makes it easier to socially progress, even if you come from a lower income background, right? Like, a poor black person from Crown Heights, you know, can put on a suit and go try to interview at some large corporation and will still be black.
Mm-hmm.
A white person from an equivalently poor area of, say, West Virginia, you know, can, if he sufficiently hides his accent, you know, or at least downplays it enough, puts on a suit, gets a haircut, goes to the same business, he's going to be regarded differently. He's going to be looked at more like he belongs.
Yeah.
And he's going to be given more benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that, like, he will succeed, but if, like, I will be black. The only two things I have to do in life are stay black and die, right?
Yep.
But, like, you know, if, like, a white person can change the flavor of white they are if they, you know, put their mind to it.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean that everyone can claw their way out of economic poverty, but it's just like you can be treated differently. There are more avenues of escape in terms of how you're treated in different places. Whereas, like, I will always be black no matter where I go. No matter what degrees I have, I will always be black. That doesn't mean that I can't succeed. It just means that, like, you know, I mean, you've seen the videos of Chris Rock getting pulled over. Chris Rock is famous as fuck.
Yeah.
He's very successful.
Yeah.
But he is still treated as a black person until they get close enough to see that he's Chris Rock.
Yeah, which is just crazy. Which is, yeah, yeah. I've seen that video, and it's so insane.
It's a series of videos. There are literally, he's made videos of him getting pulled over at least 5-10 times.
Wow. And it takes
them. It's Chris Rock.
Yeah, and it takes them.
It's not like he lives in, like, you know, some backwood. He lives in Alpine, New Jersey, one of the richest, you know, suburbs of New York City.
That's probably why he's getting pulled over, is they see him and they go, I don't know about that. Even though he's driving a $120,000 car, and he's, right. You know, but okay. So that's a abridged version of the history of, like, white supremacy and the police force and, like, how it was made to patrol runaway slaves. And then they started arresting people to replace slave labor. And, you know, there's the whole history of sundown towns and how, like, sheriffs and entire, police departments in those towns would just go around lynching people after sundown. Like, they just were like, that's how it is in our town. And, you know.
Well, the thing is with those, it was less about the police, what the police did, and more about what the police ignored.
Sure. Right?
Sometimes the police would actually participate, but, like, largely in sundown towns, it was like the police would stand by.
Yeah.
While the townsfolk did what they did.
Yeah.
And it comes back to, like, you know, sort of, let me see if I can find this quote, because this relates to sort of the foundation of all right-wing movements. And it's whether it's conservatism, whether it's fascism. So this is a quote by Frank Wilhoit.
I'll trim this up. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Take your time.
So, conservatism consists of exactly one proposition, to wit, there must be in groups whom the law protects but does not bind, alongside out groups whom the law binds but does not protect.
That's
so essentially,
it.
Yeah. That's essentially, all right wing movements are like, if I am part of the group, it's the same reason you saw that the girl who's pepper sprayed was interviewed by, like, CNN or MSNBC, yeah. Who was like, they're supposed to be shooting Black Lives Matter, not us. I can't believe they pepper sprayed me. We were doing a revolution. It's like, well, yeah, like, you tried to overthrow the government. So, you know, like, the way that they, like, basically the reason that Trump supporters went in there mask off, like, you know, ready to go, not worried about shit, was, like, partially because they thought they'd get away with it, but largely because they thought that even if they didn't, they would never face consequences because they're not the people that are supposed to be bound by the law. They're supposed to be protected by the law, but like they're the good people. So they shouldn't be arrested. They should be given leeway if they do something against the law because the law doesn't bind them. Now, black people, on the other hand, shouldn't expect protection from the law, but definitely should expect to be bound by it.
Yes.
Even if they do the smallest thing, they should be able to be in jail forever because they broke, they're criminals. They broke the law.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. That's that, that pretty much hits the nail right on the head. So we've got all of this. We've got the history. We've got the way that we've been fed propaganda to really believe in cops as our heroes and as like our brave men and women who are keeping us safe out there in the streets. We've got just the problem that everyone can acknowledge that like it's a problem if you've got this arm of the government or this institution that's like allowed to murder without accountability. That's a problem. I feel like everyone acknowledges that, but like. But the where it leaves us is like, what are we supposed to do about that? Something needs to be done about that. And all I ever hear from the other side of the argument is like, we can't do that. So like we started talking about defunding and abolishing. And usually people are like, well, obviously we can't do that. When you talked about abolish, you talked about replacing it with replacing a police force that responds to crimes and like armed situations with some kind of specialized task force, and they shouldn't be populated with former police officers. Now, if we were going to go down that road, do you think that there would be enough people for us to populate that new institution with? Like, do you think we'd and
well, especially because it would be several different institutions, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, say there's like, you know, the detective force, where the people who are the investigative force, they're investigating crimes, uh-huh. right? And they have a very specific mandate at their inception, at the creation of this organization. You know, they're investigating, trying to figure out who murdered that guy. What's up with that? You know, and that's their sole job is to find out, like, what's good? What's going on there?
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so people who are like, I want to investigate. I want to solve mysteries. I want to figure out what's going on. I want to get to the truth. Are the people who would apply for that job.
Yep.
Then there's like things like traffic enforcement, which would have to be completely rethought because first of all, fines are basically things that are legal if you have enough money.
Yeah.
But like whatever sort of reconception of traffic laws you come up with, that's so low on the priority list, but like that's a thing. Right.
Sure.
But whoever's doing traffic enforcement, you know, meter maids and people who are like handling DUIs and reckless driving and things like that, would probably be more people who just like want a job.
Uh huh.
It's like, oh, I might do retail, or I might apply to be a court stenographer, or I might apply to like work the front desk at a hotel, or like I might apply to like pull over people who are doing reckless driving.
Uh-huh. Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
There's different levels of shit and different people are going to want to apply to different things depending on like what the core mission of each of these organizations is and why that appeals to people.
Well, and people always go, "Well, yeah, but did you know that traffic stops turn deadly all the time?" And it's like, "Do you understand that that's because the person being pulled over knows that, like, so like if a cop pulls a person over who has a gun in the car and maybe they've got like a brick of cocaine under like their front seat and they don't want to go to jail tonight, it might turn into a firefight, but that's only because that person knows that like that cop has a gun too.
I might shoot him."
Yeah. So if there's no threat of a gun being introduced, there's no reason for anybody to shoot. But the police introduced
because the worst thing that somebody could do being pulled over, if there's no implied threat of gun violence from the police.
Yeah.
The worst thing that someone could do being pulled over that knows they have shit on them is to pull out a gun.
Yeah.
Because they can talk their way out of it. If it's like, all we're trying to do is be like, "Hey, don't fucking speed, guy. You could hurt somebody."
Yep.
You know, then his response most likely is just going to be, okay, I will not speed. I don't want to hurt people. My bad. And whatever consequence there is, if there is like a, I mean, there's got to be something, but I don't think any of our current punishments really work. Whatever it is, if it's like, hey, you were going 20 over, you got to do 4 hours of community service or something. Like,
yeah, sure. Know, yeah.
Whatever it is. I don't know. This is outside of my level of expertise. I'm just a guy. But like, you know, whoever's getting pulled over has less of an incentive to be scared. Basically, if two people are afraid for their lives because they think that this might turn violent and both of them have guns, there's a stronger chance of the guns being used than if nobody's afraid and everybody's just like, hey, you know, chill, man, don't speed. Like,
right, you know. Exactly. Like, I mean, the Philando Castile case is a perfect example because it's like, that was there were two things going on in that traffic stop. Like, one was right. He was like, here, I'm going to pull him over for like, I can't even remember. It was like, he didn't have
a light or some shit.
Yeah, it's like tail light or some shit. But like, the other thing that was going on was Geronimo Yanez thought that he looked like a potential suspect from a robbery. So he went into the interaction with his hand on his gun, ready for some shit to go down. And it just didn't right. need to be like that. It just didn't need right. to be. That did not need to be the intent, the energy that was brought to that interaction. The only like,
it, right. Especially because like even if like say that he had been the guy that he was mistaken for just because he was black. Right. Right. Like, you know, and he had robbed somebody.
Sure.
Most robbers are not, outside of movies, are not just going to whip out a gun and start shooting at a cop because he's like, hey, were you at the robbery? He's not going to go, oh, fuck, and just start shooting. No, it wasn't me.
Yeah.
I didn't do that. And try to, like, talk his way out of the situation and get out of there without being arrested. What? Like, that's the goal. Not to just, like, because another aspect of propaganda is portraying people who have done a crime as being, one, inherently criminal, two, inherently violent, and three, ready to just kill cops for no reason at any moment.
That was, this movie, End of Watch, is full of that. They, like, every time they pull over a person that's, like, a suspect, the person instantly whips their gun out and starts shooting, and it's, like, it's ridiculous. But, even in that situation, if I'm Geronimo Yanez, and I think I've got and let's say that we're in this new world order where traffic cops don't carry guns. Let's say I look right. at this guy and I go, this guy reminds me of someone that they posted at the office, a photo of someone from a robbery. All I've got to do yeah. is just take a mental note, write down the license plate, say, hey, slow down. You're going a little fast. I'm going to let you off with a warning tonight. And then I'm just going to let dispatch know, hey, let's look into this guy. I've got his license plate right here. It does not need to be handled right now. It does not need to be right. like, this is it. This is the moment. I'm taking him down in front of his girlfriend and her daughter in the back seat. This is the moment. Yeah. Like,
yeah. And especially like if we have this whole idea, especially because of, you know, other forms of sort of related propaganda, like, you know, the Willie Horton ad and things like that, mm-hmm. that like, if we don't stop someone who has done anything wrong, if we don't, you know, stop that jaywalker or that guy with the broken taillight right now. And, you know, and if he maybe stole something, maybe, who knows?
Uh-huh.
If we didn't stop him right this moment, he's going to commit murder. Right. Like, he's going tonight when he leaves you. If you let him go off that traffic stop, you know, without arresting him on your suspicion, he's going to rape and murder somebody like in an hour. Like, he's going to go, oh fuck. I just got pulled over. Now it's murder time. It's murder o'clock because, you know, well, I did a robbery 3 weeks ago and the cop didn't arrest me when he pulled me over. So now it's murder time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, that's pretty much it. So anyway, I want to try to wrap this up, but I think that like the thing that I hear when I talk to people about this who disagree with me on it or disagree with defund or abolish is just that they're really afraid of the solutions that are being put forward. But like, I just think sensitivity training or anything like that is just such a bullshit do nothing solution. And I feel like everyone should at least on a base level.
Seminars we've got through at jobs and not, and like half paid attention to.
Yeah.
We answered the questions and then we ate the finger sandwiches and we went back to work. Like,
yeah, it's just so grossly insufficient for such a serious, problem at the very base mm-hmm. level. Like even just in introducing like one thing that I've been talking about lately is like, maybe because judges have such a big, you know, like hard on for precedent. Like they're always like, well, if there's no precedent for it, I can't convict someone of something. So like maybe a big problem for a lot of these judges is that they're just like, there's no precedent for convicting a police officer of murder. So every time we do get one of them in court and we are able to charge them with something, they always get off because it's just kind of like, I don't want to be the first judge that hands down a life sentence to a police officer. So I've been thinking lately, like, what if we drafted up new legislation that like, it's an extra egregious offense or just a different separate offense for a police officer to commit murder because they've taken an oath.
Absolutely.
You know,
100%, 100%. I think that is very important. But I think with the from the side of judges, a lot of times the cases don't even get put before a judge.
Right.
Because, they get put before a grand jury.
Okay.
Now, a prosecutor assembling a grand jury, even if they are not a right winger like many, many of the prosecutors who have been in charge of these grand juries have been, they are incentivized by the fact that for the police to cooperate with them and give them evidence they need to build cases and to do so on time, you know, and complete packages of evidence to give them everything they need to build a case. This is bullshit, but like to give them what they need to do their job.
Yeah.
And to cooperate and to show up to testify, you know, they need to treat the cops with kid gloves because if they convict that cop, well, when they're doing their next investigation, the other cops may just not show up to court to testify or, you know, they may take an extra couple weeks to send over that evidence, you know, or they may withhold something that could have gotten a conviction so that your conviction rate goes down and then you get voted out of office. So the prosecutors, knowing this, are incentivized to help the cops because the cops help them. They're in a toxic loop of, you know, trying to incarcerate people, and the cops hold the primary power in that dynamic.
Yeah. That's another great argument for abolishment or at the very least defunding is just, it just goes to show like how corrupt and poisoned this whole system has become. And I think more and more just to take the position that it's just kind of like, well, look, they just have a tough job and they can't always get it right. And we've just got to support them is just such a like, it's unacceptable. It's no longer acceptable.
You wouldn't accept it from any other job.
Yeah, exactly.
Like people get threatened and are scared all the time working at hotels. I have had, you know, when I was working at the pod, I had people have fucking mental breakdowns. I had to deal with one time, like a Nazi. He had like a big, you know, the eagle and the swastika on his back.
Yeah.
On his back patch. He had a patch on the front and he had a hat with it, you know. And he had at least two guns that we saw right. on his person at that time. And I was a black guy working by myself. Like my coworker was on break or had left or something. And so, you know, that's a moment where I could have been scared. You know, there's a person who hates people like me and is standing in front of me with multiple guns.
Yep. Yep.
But like, they didn't give me, like, I didn't have a gun. I wasn't given a gun at my job to protect myself, even though there are people who endangered me a lot at that job, or at least potentially could have, and times when I was maybe scared, at least to an extent, you know, like, I couldn't have done like a cop and just whipped out a gun and shot the guy and been like, oh, well, I was scared.
I know.
Like, people wouldn't be like, well, you know, people in hotels get scared and sometimes they just got to shoot somebody. Like, it's okay.
And they're underpaid.
It's fine. Just take your time, bud.
Yeah, it's a stressful, underpaid job, you know, and we need them. And it's like all of these excuses. And again, it goes back to the old thing, too, of like, it's not all cops. It's a few bad apples. We talked about how it's like they say that. It's like you say that like the saying is a few bad apples aren't a big deal. You just get rid of them and the rest of the apples are fine. It's like, no, the saying is a few bad apples spoil the batch. And also, like, you're not doing anything about the bad apples. You're not getting rid of them. You're leaving them in the batch. And then also, right. Also, it's like, if these good cops are out there who agree and who are actually trying to do their best, because I have a lot of friends who go, I have a friend who's on the police force and he's such a good guy. And I'm like, then he should agree with everything we're saying. He, like, all right. of these good cops.
He should be the one who's on the front line of this.
Yes.
The cops who are saying, like, the people who are like, oh, these are such good cops should be the ones on the front lines yep. trying to get rid of. Because if they're saying there are bad cops that are tarnishing our reputation and tarnishing our profession and making people hate us, they should be like, let's get those guys the fuck out of here.
Yep, absolutely. And the fact that
they're not
yep.
says everything it needs to fucking say about the mentality of cops.
Yes. Yes. I'm going to leave it right there. There's so much more we could say on this, but I actually am glad that I'm glad that we found this topic. I think that this is a topic I haven't explored with anyone else yet on the show. And I think it's an important topic to explore, to just focus specifically on police. Yeah, man, it's really good to see you.
It's good to see you too, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I gotta have you on. So I'm not sure if I'm going to finish. I don't know where I'm at with it, but like, so I started this podcast mini series about
oh, cool.
Batman movie. And if I do an episode, if I get to doing an episode on Suicide Squad, obviously it's got to be me, you, and Arthur.
Yes.
You know, we got to get you guys, you know, I got to get the boys back in town. But, you know, I did the first episode. I'm doing it out of order. I did the first episode recorded was Batman Forever, which I did with Will and Katu and then also Matt Chrisman from Chapo Trap House.
So what's it called? It's about Batman, and what's it called?
I have not given it a name yet because the name that I originally came up with was taken. So,
well, you know that I'm so into that, and you know that I'm like super.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, please let me know. What do you think about that new Matt Reeves movie? You think it looks good?
I don't know yet. I gotta see more.
I think I'm like so stoked, just because like I'm constantly.
I think the casting is great.
Yeah.
I think casting's great.
I'm just constantly, my feelings are constantly hurt by DC movies, and I always just am like, I want it to be good so bad.
Except for Shazam.
Yeah.
Shazam's great.
Yeah. Yeah, there's good ones. There's always good ones. There's always like outliers. But my girlfriend and I right now are going through the MCU again. And I'm just so impressed by that series. I'm just like so impressed with the consistency of it. And
they lost me. I got bored, but I do like the Spider-Man ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Tom Holland's good.
Uh huh. Well, cool, man. Let's talk about Batman, next time on your show. And,
Yes.
I've got to go buy groceries with my girlfriend. But I love you.
I would say tell her hi, but she doesn't know me. So, you know,
I'll tell her you say hi.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. I love you, buddy. It's good to see you.
Love you too, man.
Okay.
Good catching up. Let's talk soon.
Okay. Bye. The police department, prosecuting attorneys all. MC Ren, Ice Cube, and Easy motherfucking E. Order. Ice Cube, take the motherfucking stand. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help your black ass? You goddamn right. But won't you tell everybody what the fuck you gotta say? Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on. Yeah, dude. Yeah. Little NWA for ya. I had to. Alright, I mean, that's Stevie, you know. We didn't get to cover all of it, but of course we never do. But you can hear that the guy knows his stuff. He knows what he's talking about. I'm really happy that I talked about this with him because, like, I knew that he would know the answers to all those questions, but I didn't know the extent to which he would know the answer to all those questions. He really, like, blew my hair back with the thoroughness of his answers and his responses to those questions. It was great to have him on. You can follow Stevie anywhere. He's usually Stevie McFly on any platform. I think on Twitter, Instagram, follow Stevie and check out what he's doing. He's a smart, funny, cool dude. I miss him. That was our first time hanging out in a while, and it was nice to just see him. I miss him. I love him. Cool. We're opening up the floor now. We're going to our favorite new segment, which is it's the Sunday Live Show on TikTok. If you're not on this, you guys, if you're listening to the podcast and you're not coming to the Sunday Live Show, you're really missing out on a really fun part of this podcast. Because now what we are doing every week is we are recording the intro and outro of People Pleaser live on TikTok every week. And the intro is written, so it's stationary. It's fixed. But the outro, I ask people in the comments of the live stream to ask questions. So we are going to go to questions now. Man, that's a good question. Okay, so this question is from CatScott_, and I think it's your name spelled backwards. I think you're making like a palindrome out of your screen name. CatScott to talk stack is your name. And the question is, what can white people change about how they engage the police to better protect BIPOC? Question mark, which is Black, Indigenous, People of Color. It's an umbrella term for several different marginalized communities. Very good question. Let's see. Let's think about it. Well, I mean, for one, here's a really good one. White people can stop weaponizing the police against BIPOC communities. How about that? How about white people stop threatening to call the cops every time they see BIPOC people doing something that they don't like? How about we stop doing that, for starters? Let's stop treating the police like they're our own personal attack dogs and calling them and threatening. You know, like, it's like, you know what you're doing. That situation where, I can't remember her name, but the woman who called the cops on the guy who told her to have her dog on a leash in the park where her dog was supposed to be leashed, she knew that what she was threatening that guy with by saying, I'm going to call the police and tell them that you're attacking me. I mean, she's threatening that guy with murder. Really, she's saying, I'll call people who will show up and kill you. So let's stop doing that. Let's also stop. I hate videos where I see white people speaking to the police with such like oozing privilege. You know, white people love to talk about how, oh, if the person in that video had just been more respectful, or if they had just done what the police had said, nothing would have happened. And it's so easy to find videos of white people being like disgustingly privileged with police officers. White women like wagging their fingers in a cop's face and being like, you don't know who I am. You don't know where I, like, you don't, I'm gonna call your boss. I have friends on the city council and we're gonna get you fired. Like that kind of thing. If the apologist's talking point is going to be about how we should respect them more, then, you know, put your money where your mouth is and show some more respect when you interact with them. But yeah, I'm not actually sure that the solution to the problem is like how white people engage with police. I think that the solution to the problem is genuinely reforming the police. So white people need to support legislation and ideas that are going to lead to police reform and actual reform, not just sensitivity training and classes and courses that they can take. So there's probably more things to say as an answer to that question. Good question. But those are some starters. Don't use the police as your personal attack dogs. Try being respectful since you tell other people to be respectful. And also, like, we just need to reform our police system. Let's get to another question here. Here's a question from John Schwalbach Zero, who says, how can the prosecutors have a conscience to not get the charges right on these situations? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with the courts. I really don't know why we can't ever get charges to stick to cops when we have them on video murdering someone. I really don't know what the deal is. I don't know if it's like judges being hung up on precedent or something, that they're just going, well, there's no precedent of convicting these people. I think I talk about this in the episode with Stevie. I can't remember. I haven't listened to it since we recorded it. So if you're listening to the episode now on Thursday or Friday and you're like, you already said that, I might be repeating myself. But maybe a solution that we need is like a new law. That it's like an extra offense if a police officer commits murder, because they're literally sworn in to protect and to not harm people who are not doing anything wrong. So if they kill an innocent person, an unarmed innocent person, and we have them on tape doing it, if, you know, Geronimo Yanez shoots Philando Castile 7 times while he's in his car, and we know from all the evidence that Philando Castile did not do anything wrong, there needs to be like a new law that says that that form of murder is a different charge. Cause maybe that will get judges to be like, oh, there's no precedent around this law. It's a new law. And as the first person charged with this new law, yes, you will be convicted of murder and you will obviously lose your job and go to prison. So I don't really know what it is. I don't know if it's that they're hung up on precedent or if it is just garden variety racism that the prosecutors and judges and attorneys general are all sort of in on this thing together, or if it's just sort of like the gang team mentality of everyone like staying together, that the police and the prosecutors sort of work in tandem, that the police keep the prosecutors employed by bringing them these cases, and it's sort of a you scratch my back, I scratch yours situation. I don't know what it is, but like all of that is contributing to the shitstorm. And all of that needs to be addressed in the reform. So good question. KE.Watt.OG says, yeah, that's not fast enough though. We need radical change now. They kill too many. I agree. We need radical change yesterday. We need radical change, 100 years ago. So yeah, absolutely. I agree. But we are in the situation that we're in, and we've got to try to move and make some moves. It's kind of like the minimum wage thing, how they were like, we're gonna have plans to make minimum wage $15 by 2025. It's like, oh cool, so you mean like the wage that it should have been in 1990? Like, thanks, I guess. But you know, I guess some change is better than none change. Let's go to another question here. LuluBees23 says, what are models that work when it comes to social workers replacing / working with police? I think Stevie addresses this in the conversation, so definitely listen when the episode drops on Wednesday night. But yeah, it's kind of just what you just said. It's like introducing different factions of government employees who deal with different situations. So if there's a domestic dispute or a mental health issue happening, if someone's having, you know, a manic episode who's bipolar and they're off their medication, having different people that can respond to different situations rather than always having it be the people with guns show up ready to shoot their guns at the problem. That can't be our solution for everything. So I'm not exactly sure of the details on like what the models are, and that's not really my job. I'm not like the person who's drafting up the actual like, here's what it's going to look like. But I know that there are people doing that work, you know, people involved with Black Lives Matter and social justice reform movements and stuff. But that is a good question, and it's good to just talk about like what's actually being mentioned is when people talk about that, of social workers working with or replacing. It's not fully replacing the people with guns. There would still be reasons for the guys with guns to show up and respond to like violent threats where people have guns and guns are involved. But the guys with guns, well, not just guys, but the people with guns don't need to show up to every single threat, is basically the gist of the idea behind having multiple trained government entities or employees that could, you know, community organizations that could respond to different kinds of issues. Hope that makes sense. Thank you for the question. Shane and Adine says, we need to have emotional intelligence testing for cops. Yeah, probably. I don't know what that would look like, but geez, yeah. Because they all seem so not emotionally ready to handle situations. I mean, like the cop that I talked about in the intro, like, he wasn't ready emotionally to handle a 9-year-old who was in the midst of an emotional crisis. He encountered a 9-year-old who was in the middle of an emotional crisis, and he wasn't emotionally equipped to deal with her, which is just a problem. And it's also a problem that it's a safe bet to say that he would have maybe magically been somehow more emotionally equipped if she were white. Lauren asks, what are your thoughts on the minimum wage? My thoughts on the minimum wage? It's way, 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 way too low. $15 is too low. It's just too low. I worked at a restaurant where I made like $20 to $25 in an hour with tips. It's too low. It's not enough to pay rent in most cities. It's not enough. It's just not enough. And this whole idea of like raising minimum wage will mean that prices will go up. Or how about the CEO just makes less? How about that? CEOs, like the people at the top have been making exponentially more over the last 40 years since Reaganomics really took hold. They've been making exponentially more year after year after year. And rather than looking at that, we go, well, if we raise people's wages, then prices will go up. Or the people at the top whose wages have, or whose earnings have just ballooned to an astronomical, immoral rate will just have to go down a little bit and they'll be fine. That's my thoughts on minimum wage. That'll be my last question for the podcast. Thank you all so much for participating and for asking your questions today. Stay on the live. I'm going to answer some more questions, but I'm just going to wrap up the podcast here right after this. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. The show is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. If you've got an audio project, a podcast, a song, a EP, an album, an audiobook, whatever it is that you're doing that you need audio engineering for, some mixing, mastering, some polishing, some professional work done to make your thing sound the best that it possibly can sound, hit up Chris. Hit up Chris at themarmalademusic.com. His website changed. It used to be Marmalade Music SLC. If you listen to back episodes of People Pleaser, you'll hear me saying marmalademusicslc.com. The website changed. It's themarmalademusic.com. Hit up Chris. Tell him that you need help. Tell him that you heard about him from me. Say, Austin sent me from the podcast, and he'll give you 20% off your first project. How about that? 20% off your first project. If you say, Austin sent me, do it. Love you guys. That's the podcast. Stay safe out there. Wear your mask. Be nice to each other. Bye-bye.